I want to welcome to the stage a man that I think is doing very important work. I know that his name and his channel, Ice Age Farmer, has really blown up over the last year. Many of you have probably heard of it and some of the reports he's been doing. I think he's doing some essential work, both talking about the grand solar minimum, as well as the expectation and the maybe kind of purposeful food shortages that we might be facing. So we're going to hear about that and more. We're going to hear about the greater food transformation. Please welcome to the stage, Christian Westbrook.
Thank you so much, Derek, and thank you all for being here. It is a real honor to be speaking with you and sharing the stage today with Marjorie and Jack, two of my heroes for a long time, even before I started the channel, and more broadly with all the voices this week, and coming together to really respond to set an intention and respond to the great reset that the technocrats have in mind for us. I don't like to focus a lot. You know, I don't like the doom and gloom. And we just heard Marjorie talking about how our thoughts manifest reality. So it wouldn't make a lot of sense to pay much attention to these crazies, except that when we set that intention, you know, I can intend to get $1 million tomorrow, but that's just not going to happen. So our intentions and our dreams have to be grounded upon a deep understanding of what's really going on in the world, or else they're not going to land there. And so to that end, we'll speak briefly about what I see going on, and then get to the good part, which is how do we respond to that? Because, you know, just as the Great Reset includes what the UN and others are calling the Great Food Transformation, I think our greater reset must include, and that's what this conversation now is about, the greater food reset. Food, after all, is fundamental. We all eat every day. And so we need to address this so that we can actually have the rest of these conversations meaningfully about currencies and schooling and the future we want to leave, to build and leave to our children. So the greater food transformation in that light is the transition to a decentralized food production, an emergent empowered food system. And when I say it's a transition to it, I really mean it's a transition back to that decentralized model, because that's, after all, the way humanity has always worked, right? Is we all just grew food. It wasn't until relatively recently that we started getting food from these multinational companies with their weird, terrible, earth-destroying, health-destroying practices. So how do we move back to that? But I still think it's fair to call it a greater food transformation, because transformation is fundamentally about consciousness. And that's why I think we're still going through a transformation here. So briefly, let me pull up a couple things, because I want to make sure that we see some of the ideas and the people and the logos and the catchphrases behind the great food transformation, the things the technocrats, want to wish upon us. And so, as I mentioned, the UN has been for some time talking about the need to totally transform the human diet, to get people to stop eating meat. A lot of this came out through the IPCC reports about global warming and cow farts, right? We've heard the case, sort of the foundation for this case, be laid for a long time. They want to eliminate animal source foods, so not just meat, but anything that comes from animals, and move us towards insect protein and lab-grown meat. And a lot of this was codified towards the end of 2019 when the Eat Lancet Commission, which is the joint venture between EAT, which openly describes itself as Davos for food, joined forces with the Lancet Commission, which is a longstanding healthcare, medical care, health sort of an organization. You've heard their name mentioned plenty of times in the coronavirus stuff, joined together, and they formulated what they called the Planetary Health Diet, which is what they describe as what we all need to eat in order to be able to feed the growing population within planetary boundaries, is sort of their catchphrase. And of course, the World Economic Forum jumped on this and they published articles. This is what we all need to go to, is this planetary health diet in order to save the world. They really don't, they're not very subtle with their intentions here to force this upon us. And they tie it in with the Agenda 2030, the UN Sustainable Development Goals, and describe it as the 21st century great food transformation. So the Eat Lancet diet, in that report, they actually used this phrase that really stuck out to me, because again, this is in late 2019, and they announced that food is the single strongest lever to optimize human health on the one hand and environmental sustainability on Earth on the other. And so during the course of 2020, you know, we had the plandemic, this huge human health crisis, and then they're now calling global warming an existential crisis as well. So both of these areas are the global problems that they have concocted that they're telling us are, this is why we have to save the Earth, right? And global problems require global solutions. We actually heard Rosa on Monday talk about they need these big Earth scale problems to justify the global governance. And so these are the two things that that they're telling us. In fact, they told us in advance of the pandemic would be necessary, and that food is the key to solving them. And they intend to pull that lever. And what that means is they're taking control over the food supply. As 2020 played out and the pandemic sort of gave them cover fire, we saw all of the agendas of the technocrats blitz forward at breakneck speed, including this great food transformation. The Rockefeller Foundation released something they call Reset the Table, which is describes a series of things necessary to do. But again, you can see right on its face, they call it a complete fundamental transformation of the food system. So in the US, the Rockefellers were describing one of the key things they did here was say, well, now that we've got this pandemic, it turns out that human health is really, it's important what you eat. It turns out it's important what you eat. We were kind of wrong with our Rockefeller Green Revolution, where we just pumped out empty calories and depleted the topsoil. So now, in the name of public health, we also have to take control of food. And they married these two things together to justify the medical martial law extending into control over the food supply, and again, control over what we eat. So in the US, the Rockefellers described it as resetting the table. In the EU, exact same Agenda 2030 style language, they described it a farm to fork strategy. And then just in December last month, Barilla, the Italian pasta company, combined both of these names into their resetting the food system from farm to fork, which was a, you know, a series of private public partnerships. And they have a food think tank, which is called appropriately Food Tank. And so it's all of the same sorts of things that we see across any of these agendas, but applied directly to food and to taking control over it into these multinational companies and these global organizations. Barilla was very clear. It was not hidden at all. In the CEO's opening remarks, he said, what we're doing today is setting the stage for the UN's World Food Systems Summit, which is actually happening in a few days here. They just opened up their conference boards a couple days ago, and I signed up to see what's going on there. And the UN's World Food Systems Summit is, like all of these things on their sustainable development goals, launching right now to sort of set the course for what they're calling the Decade of Action, this lead up to the 2030 milestones that they've set for a number of these agendas, absolutely including food. And they were pretty clear that we should expect to experience vertigo as we go through these rapid changes in the coming years. And I will just mention briefly this report from a company or an organization called AgriWatch, where they were able to trace the person that's heading up the UN World Food Systems was put into that position based on a series of recommendations from 12 people, 11 of whom literally take money directly from Bill Gates. So I thought this was a great example. You know, we know his influence of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation money is all throughout a lot of agriculture, and he's running projects that try to take control over the genomes of seeds. This is called his Ag1 program. Vandana Shiva, I regret that she didn't make it today because she is, you know, in her Oneness versus the 1% book, very actively calling out Gates and even the Rockefellers as this new Green Revolution 2.0 that is taking control over the genomes of all of the heirloom genetics seeds on Earth, and then using CRISPR modifications to take control over it and patent it. Really, they're taking ownership of God's creation and then selling it back to us, and it's astounding what's going on. So let me stop sharing and then say, okay, I think we've focused enough on these crazy people and what they're doing. But if we don't understand that these are their goals and that they seek to not only create these fake synthetic foods and force them literally down our throats, but also to preclude us from growing our own food. You know, we heard Spirko say that there's a war on livestock, on animal agriculture. I've mentioned the Impossible Foods CEO, again, funded by Bill Gates. Open mission statement of that company is to end animal agriculture. And we talked a little bit earlier about why I think that's their goal. But suffice to say, it's not just, we unfortunately can't just grow our own food and then think we're going to be safe. Part of the greater food transformation that we're describing today has to be protecting, you know, fostering and protecting from these technocrats our ability to grow our own food. And so I've now spent years looking at this agenda and their goals and the future they want to bring. And I thought and I thought and I thought about what do we do? How do we do this? And I thought until I could think no more. And finally, my wife said, "What are you doing, Christian? You know, the great reset, the greater reset, it's not going to happen here. The greater reset happens in the heart." And I think she nailed it. I think she's exactly right. We've heard a lot of that this week. And so what needs to happen as we return to our understanding of ourselves, all of us as powerful beings who can who can imagine new solutions and bring them to creation in the world, is we step back into that role. We take our power back. And as we do that, and as we start growing our own food for our families and our communities gradually, it will organically, so to speak, it will organically happen that a new food system emerges from these efforts. Fortunately, that's also the only rational response to what's going on, to their efforts to create a centralized, controlled system, is to decentralize production, is to do the opposite of that, right? So when we decentralize production, and that's, again, that's what we have always done up until relatively recently, was we all grew a little bit of food, then this new emergent food production system is created. So yeah, we all grow food. And now I want to talk a little bit about how we do that, what that looks like, starting from the individual level, which is where we have control, right? That's our sphere of control, our sphere of influence. And then thinking a little bit about what that emergent system looks like, how it all fits together, and where we go from there. So in terms of growing food, how do we do it? The decentralized food production system, again, it's traditional human ways of doing things. It feels good to grow your own food. It makes more nutritive food. It restores also our spiritual connection, I think, to the earth and to cycles and its forces that are bigger than we are. And it also connects us again to our food, right? We're not just buying Soylent Green from the store. We're now having an experience and a story of the plants and the animals that we're working with. Fukuoka, Manitoba, who wrote One Straw Revolution, actually on his farm, there's no electricity there, and he keeps anyone from bringing their devices or anything onto the farm, because he says that farmers need to be highly attuned with their environment and with the energies and the cycles of the farm. And these devices and even electricity just desensitizes you. So I thought that was pretty interesting. The other thing that's great about growing your own food is one of these quotes from Jeff Lawton, who says, I'm sorry, from Bill Mollison, actually, the other permaculture guy, who says that there's something inherently seditious about permaculture, isn't there? Because you can't control a man who doesn't need you. And of course, we know from Henry Kissinger that if you control food, you control the people. So they totally intend on using food to take control of humanity. And all of this underscores the need for us all to start growing food. So how do we do that? I mentioned in the roundtable, the really good news first, there is no one prescribed way to feed your family. There are a myriad number of different approaches and things that you can do to create nutrition for your family and to feed yourselves. I've made a point on my channel, the Ice Age Farmer channel, to connect with different people, including Marjorie, from whom we just heard about her three-part system to grow half your food, Gabe Brown, who's a regenerative rancher in North Dakota, a Hopi dry farmer named Michael Kotutwa, who is able to grow all the food he needs even though he's only got one monsoon season and then a huge dry season in Arizona there. And all of these people are really, and you know, Jack Spierko is going to talk to us about aquaculture and aquaponics. And so there are really smart people who are thinking about this problem, and they're reaching different solutions. They're getting to different places. And again, this tells us that that there is no one box that we need to check. This is how we do it. And as I mentioned earlier, where I think this process can start for each of us is to sort of take an honest look at what we want to eat and what we need to eat, and then think through where we are, whether we're in a dry climate or a cold climate, whatever the context of your homestead is, what can you grow there? And then again, gradually work to bring these two things together. How do we meet these needs given what we can do? And there's not going to be one single way to do it. One thing that I do think, though, is universal within that framework is the five principles of good soil husbandry. So I'll come back to those in a bit here. And I'm not going to go too far into the growing food aspects here, because I've got Marjorie and Jack Spierko on either side of this talk focusing on that. So, and there's plenty of amazing resources on anywhere on the internet or YouTube, but let's get off YouTube. But anywhere you look, there's tons of fantastic books, right? This is something that there's just a wealth of resources out there, and you just need to start looking around. But I do want to say that seeds are an absolutely critical part of this equation here. Seeds learn. Plants learn. And when you grow a crop in your locale, it actually adapts and it learns a little bit. Matt Powers, who's another permaculture teacher that I've interviewed on my show, tells a story about getting some Hopi corn from South America, where they have a very long growing season, and trying to grow it in California, which also does, but somehow the corn still didn't have enough time to get to bearing, you know, kernels on most of his plants. But there were a couple here or there that just barely eked out a crop. And so he saved those seeds. And the next season, he planted them. And that year, all of the corn came to maturity and yielded fantastically. And it cut like 2 weeks off of the growth cycle of that corn, just by virtue of the fact that it had already been there for one season. It had already struggled and learned that things happen a little bit faster in California than they did wherever the seed was grown previously. And this is true of any plant, of any seeds that you find. So rather than just buying seeds from a seed catalog that come from, you know, Missouri, and then you have to go through this adaptation process, take a season or two to get them up to speed with where you are, I think it's absolutely a jump start to go find your neighbors who are growing food already and ask them, you know, because if they've got seeds, not only can they, I'm sure they'll be willing, they'll have so many of them, they'll be willing to share those seeds with you, but they come with a story. Oh, these really like shade in the afternoon, or these, you know, were really thirsty during the summer months. They can tell you so much information and context that you don't get when you just order seeds online. Seeds are true wealth. A few other places you can find seeds locally, and that's the real emphasis almost across the board here, but especially for seeds that have already learned, and you can benefit from that, from your neighbors, from seed libraries. A lot of public libraries have, you know, card catalogs that have been repurposed now as seed collections, and you can go borrow a few seeds and then take them back at the end of the season. You can find seed swaps going on in your area. You can connect with the state schools. Will have often local county ag extensions, and a lot of those will have seeds that you can have for free to start, not to mention programs where you can get financial help if you want to build a hoop house. There's a lot of resources at those state ag extensions, so definitely connect with people there. Look for master gardeners clubs, although some of those guys are using glyphosate, so you still have to use your discernment, as with everything in life. But from any of these places, you can get seeds and stories that are so much more robust than you do if you just go to, you know, certainly if you go to Amazon.com and start clicking around. So I wanted to really emphasize that, because seeds are everything. Seeds are wealth. And the other thing that emphasizes this for us, again, let's look back at these technocrats and what they're doing. And what they have been doing for generations is buying up all of the seed companies and consolidating these genetics into, now it's just Monsanto and Syngenta and these big seed companies that own it all, and they want to license it out. And this is what I mentioned, Bill Gates and Ag One going out and sucking up all of the genetics from all the indigenous farmers across the world so they can turn around and sell them patented seeds. So their actions there inform us that there's something really valuable about seeds. That's why they want them, and that's why we should save them and stay with them. And I think that we could get back to a point. It used to be like this, and we can get back to a point where I can say, oh, these are your great uncle's golden beets, and this is your grandfather's kale, or whatever it is. That's where a lot of these heirloom varieties have crazy names, because they come, that's part of their story. They come with names of the people or the places or whatever that those seeds, their providence, where they came from. And after all, when people came to new places, wheat was brought to Canada, seed potatoes were brought across the frontier in the West, because that's part of being human, is you have to eat. And so people would bring the seeds with them. And so all of this really just to underscore how important seeds are in this, the greater food transformation. Animals as well. Again, you can look at the technocrats. They're trying to end animal agriculture. This can inform us that animals are important, not to mention just common sense. Like I mentioned earlier, animals are a very critical part of running a homestead. Even if you don't eat them, you need that link in the chain of the nutrient cycle to keep the nutrients flowing through your site, whether it's just a aquaponic system and the fish in there, or it's a small scale homestead, or even up to the big farm like Gabe Brown, where he's running, herds of cattle across his land and letting them drop manure to fertilize the pasture and keep everything running and producing there. Without that link, you become dependent on fertilizers and external inputs. And again, you're then dependent on the system. And it is that dependence which is our vulnerability. So I think that's why the attack on livestock and animals is going on. And that's why we need to think about raising animals. So wherever you are, again, look at your context and figure out what would work where you are. If you don't have much space, that might speak to the rabbits or the quail, like Marjorie mentioned. If you do, you can start looking at some chickens or goats or alpaca, if you want some fur to look at, even fish, whatever aligns with your needs and your context, give it a go. And right now I'm working through chickens and rabbits, chickens for the eggs and rabbits for the meat. And I will tell you that it's very informative when you raise your own meat for protein, because you connect with it on an entirely different level. You want to really make sure that you give these animals the absolute best life that you can, because if and when the time comes that you're looking at that animal and saying, okay, this is the end of the road for you, then you really want to know that you have done everything you can to give them absolute comfort and even luxury. And this is just the way that that part of the story ends. So this is part of building a more conscious food system. And then even with the animals, as with yourself and with your homestead, you go through this exercise of self-sufficiency. Well, earlier I was just buying eggs. Then I got some chickens and I was buying feed for the chickens, but I was still going to the store for the feed. So maybe I'll plant some barley and rye and grow some fodder, maybe microgreens to feed my chickens. Okay, that's great. But now I need those seeds. Okay, so you just keep iterating. Now I need to grow some of those things, let them go to seed and save those seeds so that next year I'll be able to create and keep this cycle running. And you just keep iterating like that on everything. How do I remove my dependencies on external inputs? You do that for everything. And you do that for your homestead as far as you can. And at some point, it ceases to be pragmatic you just can't do everything yourself. And that's where, again, going back to the talks we heard on Monday, that's where you start looking at, okay, how do I, as a unit within my freedom cell or my neighborhood, whatever you want to think of this as, how do I do the same exercise? What do we need as a group to keep this running? And then what do we need as a community And if I'm growing chickens and they're growing alpacas and I can get milk from the dairy goats next door, how do we as this now this unit do the same thing that I was, the same exercise that we described as a homestead? And then ultimately you're looking at doing it like a state or even a nation level. There is a point, right, at which you get to some core things that just, it's, you know, like a salt block. Like, I don't have ocean nearby. And so that's where you start to say, well, maybe we do need to interact with people who are hundreds of miles away. That's why I love some of the conversations about hierarchies. And I don't mean hierarchies like leadership and, you know, people telling you what to do. I mean hierarchies of units and self-sufficient units building upon each other and with each other and working to get that sea salt over further inland, trading for eggs, whatever. However that looks, that's a conversation we can have as these things are materializing. So we've talked a little bit about permaculture and this idea that we're building regenerative systems. But now what happens if we start doing all of this? What happens as individuals around you start becoming more self-sufficient, producing more of their own food, trading for the parts of it that they can't do given their space or resource constraints, whatever, then all of a sudden you get to an emergent, regenerative, distributed food system. It actually happens more quickly than you might think. And that's a good thing. You don't need corporate inputs. We've cut them out. We've cut out our dependence on them. We don't need petroleum-based fertilizers. We're not using mass monocropping. We've gotten away with, thank goodness, those disgusting CAFOs, right? The concentrated animal, the factory farming. It is I don't even have words for how horrendous those things are. But we can't point at that and say we need to end animal agriculture, which is what they're doing, of course. They're pointing at the things that they have created and saying we need to stop eating meat. No, we need to put them out of business. One of my favorite quotes from Marjorie is, if only one third of us had chickens in our backyard, we would obviate the need for factory farms of chickens laying eggs. We'd walk away from it. We wouldn't have to change the laws or petition them or, you know, do any corporate government. No, we just walk away from it. And that is a real greater food transformation as I see it. Walk away from these things. No need to fight them, which would just empower them. We just create a better alternative. So the greater food transformation, particularly in light of some things I don't want to focus on tonight, but yeah, I think there are engineered food shortages at play right now in order to ensure that people are forced into succumbing to the agenda for fake food and lab-grown meat and all these things. It's also tying into the attack on livestock, because right now we're seeing some real problems with soybeans and corn, which all, of course, a lot of that goes into animal feed. And if people can't feed their animals, then this also spells the demise of animal agriculture. So there's a risk that this greater food transformation will be a bit of a rough transition. And that's why I think we need to think about how we can accelerate this transformation. How do we quickly rebuild the human food ecosystem? Because that's what it is, right? It's a bunch of units and people and families and communities growing their own food and working together. It is an ecosystem. And so actually I did the same thing. I thought and I thought and I thought, and it wasn't until I did a meditation and it sort of came to me that humanity itself is a damaged ecosystem. You know, we talk about regenerative agriculture and these principles of soil management and all these things that we can do to take a damaged site and breathe life back into it and start the virtuous cycles of creating more organic matter and rebuilding the soil life. That's exactly what we have to do as humanity. We are a disrupted ecosystem. We've been disconnected from nature. We've been divorced from our neighbors and cut off from the resources we need to feed our families. So I started wondering, what happens if we map all of these principles, these regenerative agricultural principles, onto this idea of our new distributed food system, our emergent food production? It is, after all, the most rich ecosystem, the most robust, resilient thing that I can imagine is soil. And so what are those five soil principles. How do we, to borrow a term from them, build back better as humanity? And I'm going to go back to, not to Bill Gates, but to this list of the five principles of good soil husbandry. Because these are, I mentioned them earlier and I want to hit them now because I do think they are fundamental. Again, they work on any scale, whether you're talking about protecting the life in an aquaponic system or in soil that's in a small container garden on your garden windowsill, whatever, all the way up to a garden in your backyard or even a huge operation. These are remain true and they always work. So let's look at them. We want to minimize disturbance to the soil because, after all, we're creating a home for healthy soil biological life. And if you go in there and you rip up the soil, obviously you destroy their home, and so they're going to die. So that's, you don't want to do that. This informs a lot of the no-till kind of practices that we hear about out there. For the same reasons, we want to keep the soil covered. Gabe Brown calls it an armor on the soil at all times. So wind doesn't blow, erode away the soil. The sun doesn't beat down and superheat it and then kill off the soil life. These two things speak to protecting the life within it. We also want to keep a living root in the soil at all times. This is why cover crops are important, because it is by virtue of this plant growing in the soil, taking energy from the sun and then turning it into exudates and sugars and feeding those into the soil. That's how the all that biological life in the soil is fed. So you have to keep, even in the cold season months, you want to keep something growing, some cover crop of some kind, doing that, taking the sun's energy and feeding it in, making sure nutrition is getting to your soil life. And then biodiversity, obviously, yeah, you want as many different kinds of plants doing that as possible, because they're all going to feed slightly different kinds of exudates into the soil, different profiles of this or that. And one of them, maybe you have a very cold day and some of the plants die, but you've got others there to take the, you know, this is the opposite of monocropping. So we want to maximize biodiversity. And then, yeah, integrating animals, again, for all the reasons I've already enumerated, they are just hugely important to a regenerative, holistic operation. So now, as I said, what happens if we take those same five principles and we think about what does this look like for us, for our greater food transformation, for our emergent food system? So I created these principles of our greater food transformation. One, again, minimize disturbance. And in this case, it means deregulating, I think, getting all of the things that are disturbing, potentially, our ability to have a local food system and healthy counter-economic activity, getting them out of here. Take away any restrictions. One example of this I like is the Wyoming HB 155 that they passed last year, after the pandemic had started shutting down meat plants, because the law, federal law, says that if you're selling meat to consumers, you have to get it inspected and processed at a USDA approved facility. Well, those were closing down because of the pandemic. And so this is why, unfortunately, you know, millions of animals were culled last year, because the pipelines were stopped and there was no place for ranchers and producers to take their animals. Wyoming alone took the step of saying, okay, this is insanity. This is completely ridiculous. And they opened up, they defined this this opening, and they amended the law so that it could happen for ranchers and producers to be able to sell meat directly to consumers. They got the government out of the way so that we could continue to feed ourselves. I mean, it's just insane when you step back enough that there's any red tape that would keep us from feeding ourselves, particularly given everything that's going on right now. So there's one example of how I think we minimize disturbance to our local food production. Armor. Again, this goes hand in hand, just as it did with the soil, but we want to protect that. We need to codify laws or, you know, any, I don't know what this looks like, but one example would be, yeah, laws to help protect our right to grow food. Florida had it was called HB 1776, appropriately. It was a law that sadly did not pass, but it said at the state level, look, municipalities and counties, you're not allowed to get in the way of people growing food. And this was after there was a couple that had planted a garden in their front yard, and the city came along and gave them a ticket and said they had to get rid of it and put grass there because this is a neighborhood. What are you thinking? It has to look good. It has to be grass. So our property values are going, who knows what they were actually thinking, what actually motivates this in some technocrat's mind. But the state, because of the media coverage, floated this law that said, no, you can't do that. If someone owns property, they're allowed to grow food. And so I think this is an example of the kinds of armor that we need to give our local food systems to protect the people that are growing, the people that are bringing the food to market, and the consumers for that matter. So we need laws, and we need sheriffs to understand the importance of enforcing these laws at the local level to make sure that, again, that we have done everything we can to facilitate and get out of the way of local food systems. Feeding and nourishing our food systems. How do we do that? Again, we want to incentivize people to grow their own food. We want to facilitate all this counter economic activity, whether that takes the form of tax breaks for people that are using their land to grow food, or even for restaurants who are exclusively sourcing from local food. Maybe you give them other incentives to make sure that the local food does have a market, that it's not eclipsed by what looks like cheap food coming from Sysco and big multinational companies. But we already know it's toxic and devoid of nutrition. So this is, we're now making sure that we're going to feed and nourish our local food system. And, I don't have all the answers here. I really am open to all of the suggestions. I'll give you my email address here in a second, because I think this is part of the dialogue that we all need to be having right now, is how do we do this? What does this look like? How do we feed and nourish local counter-economic food activity? Biodiversity, I think, is another easy one, right? Just as we wanted to have as many different kinds of plants as possible in the ground to make a resilient production, so too should we have different people doing different things. Fortunately, this comes because people are awesomely different from each other by nature. But again, if I'm raising chickens, then my neighbor down the street is actually raising the dairy cows. Neighbor on the other side has alpacas, which are amazing for fur. And then someone further down also has chickens. And in this case, if I lose my chickens in a terrible, some bear comes along and destroys the coop, then it's not the end of the world. Humans, and this has been, this is the case since the dawn of time, people do lose crops or animals or what have you. And we have to be there for each other. So a diverse, rich ecosystem in our local food environment means we can be there. We can cover for each other when these emergencies do happen. I can get more eggs to hatch from my friend down the street and reboot my flock and get back in gear here. This is just a natural element of building a resilient food system. And then, integrating animals. Yes, not only in our farms, but across all of these ideas. And again, given that animal agriculture is under attack, I think the emphasis here right now is protecting our ability to raise animals. There's some examples in the UK right now where officials, it's called DEFRA, it's like their USDA in the UK, and they're pointing at massive poultry operations and saying, oh, there was a bird flu outbreak here. And so they're literally going around right now in the vicinity of these poultry operations and gassing people's chickens. And it's tremendously disturbing to me, not just because of the obvious, the chickens, but because this is something that humans have done forever. We raise animals, we live with them, and they feed us and we feed them and we work together. And to deny people that, to strip them of their animals, is just criminal beyond belief. I actually sent the DEFRA agency a FOIA request yesterday demanding to understand how they can possibly justify doing this. We'll see if I hear anything. But the point is, we can't allow this to happen. We have to push back at all levels, from the local to the federal and anything you can imagine. We must defend. This ties back to the armor. Defend our ability to raise animals and to grow our own food, which is sadly under attack right now. So that was one way of framing this. How do we create our emergent, regenerative, nourishing, and massively decentralized, robust, resilient food system that will be feeding our families and our children after them, and insulating us from these ridiculous fake foods and the agendas they're trying to force down our throats right now. Supporting local farmers and ranchers, becoming a local farmer and a rancher, I think is, we should all be doing this. But even beyond just growing food, there are roles for, particularly given the reality that we assessed earlier in this talk where we said we're under attack right now, particularly in light of that, there are roles for people that are in public policy, people that are, you know, lawyers, people that are who can fight these onerous regulations and do some of the things I'm talking about here. There's also plenty of room for, you know, web developers. When the pandemic was hitting and a lot of restaurants and schools were closing down, there were farmers who lost their channels to get food to market. And that means, you know, you can't just say, oh, I guess it's game over. It means there's a need for people who are web developers to step up and say, hey, Farmer Joe down the street, I'm happy to stand you up a website with a shopping cart or a little CSA interface thing, whatever it is you need to help get your operation running and connect, reconnect the producer to the consumer. Let's get this reconnected. So it's going to take farmers. Yes, we should all be growing food, but my point is lawyers, politicians, webmasters. I guarantee whatever it is you do, whatever walk of life you come from, whatever unique experiences and expertise you have, I promise you, we need that right now as part of this greater food transformation. I do think that some of the food shortages we'll have in the future here will be the catalyst that gets a lot more people thinking critically about food and where we're going here. And when that happens, as it happens, it will be we having this conversation now who are there with seeds that we've saved and chicks that we've raised that we can share with them and baby rabbits, you know, whatever, to help them get started and do the same thing that we all need to be doing right now. What that means is that you and I are the seeds of tomorrow's victory gardens. That is the greater food transformation. This is the foundation of it. And that food is the, you know, the basis for all of the conversations we're having this week, the greater reset as a whole. Thank you for joining me in building it.
Thank you, Christian.
Actually, I can close one more thought, actually. There was a...
They love you, man.
Thank you for that. Yeah, I appreciate that. I saw earlier today a tweet from the UN that said, food is an essential human right. And I thought about that because it looks good. It sounds good, right? We should all eat every day. But there's a catch there. Implicit in the way they phrased that is that this right to food means that we have the right to a state, to a global state that is aware of all the food we have and all the food people have. And it means we have a right to this state that has a monopoly on force to be able to take food from you and give it to someone else who needs it more in their eyes. And so what the UN is telling us is that we have the right to be slaves. And so we have to reject that. What we have a right to is growing our own food. And ironically, it's that they're trying to take away from us right now. And so I just wanted to make clear that it sounds good. It's a right to food, but no, the way we actually deliver on that promise and make sure that there is abundant food for all of us is this greater food reset. So thank you very much.
Thank you, brother. Thank you again.
As we wake up to a new normal today and life is slowly grinding to a halt.
Now masks are becoming the new normal.
Americans are facing a new normal, one that may include losing their jobs, losing their income, and even losing their health insurance.
I don't think we get back to normal. I think we get back, or we get to a new normal.
It's time to reject the new normal. Now is the historical moment, the time, not only to fight severe virus, but to shape the system.
It's time to reject the Great Reset.
It's time to support the People's Reset.
It's time for the Greater Reset.
From January 25th to the 29th, journalists, activists, researchers, and advocates are hosting the Greater Reset Activation, a five-day event dedicated to offering an alternative to the World Economic Forum's top-down, centralized, authoritarian vision. Our desire is to help all people find community and liberty by providing practical steps and knowledge for co-creating a world that respects individual liberty, bodily autonomy, and choice.
The Greater Reset is the world's collective response to the World Economic Forum's initiative, The Great Reset. We invite you to join us for 5 days of discussion about the diverse opportunities available for those who seek to live in harmony with humanity and the planet while respecting our innate freedom.
Each day is dedicated to a different domain and provides solutions to the WEF's vision. Day one is dedicated to the Agora and decentralized economics. Tuesday, the 26th, will focus on health and education. Day three will focus on nature, permaculture, and regenerative agriculture. Thursday, the 28th, will highlight the liberating side of digital technology, including encryption, blockchain, and decentralized autonomous organizations. On Friday, January 29th, we will end the event by showcasing examples of intentional communities, freedom cells, and community organizing.
Don't miss out on this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to hear from some of the most powerful speakers in the world with a focus on solutions. We encourage everyone to organize local watch parties in your area using freedomcells.org. Also, find out more about the Greater Getaway in-person event in Zihuatanejo, Mexico. Visit thegreaterreset.org for more information.